Hi there, it's Jorge Tamames. This is Europe's New Political Economy. Welcome back for another episode, our 15th episode so far. Our guest today is Kevin Cunningham. He is a lecturer in politics at Technological University Dublin, but crucially, he has also worked as campaigns targeting and analysis manager for Labour in the United Kingdom. So that means that, like the previous episode, we have another conversation that bridges the gap between academia and politics. Throughout the following hour, you'll learn about the different ways in which statisticians and political economists look at social class and whether it makes sense at all, in fact, to talk about social class in relationship to electoral politics. A feature of most of our societies today is that we don't have the same class structure as back in the early 20th century or even the post-war years, when it was possible to establish a clear difference between, for example, manual laborers who belong to the working class and the middle and upper classes. These cleavages, in turn, came with clear voting preferences that today have become much harder to predict. That is why we witness increased political volatility across much of Europe and North America. So, Kevin and Aidan will debate the ways in which different age, occupational, gender, geographic, and educational cleavages structure voting patterns in most Western countries, among other things. Some of the examples that we'll debate include, like the previous episode, Sinn Féin and left populism in Ireland, as well as Irish party politics more broadly, UKIP and Labour in the United Kingdom, and the Republican and Democratic parties in the United States. So, off we go to the conversation.
Listen, Kevin, great to see you.
Great to see you too.
Good to have a chat again.
Yes.
So, Kevin, you know, you're now one of the experts in Ireland and polling and data and getting a sense of how people vote. I think I'm going to say that anyway. I think it's true.
Thanks. But, I really appreciate that. Dave McWilliamson is Ireland's top pollster.
Yeah,
Magazine remains unconvinced, I think, as well, though. But, you know,
so. I think how's everything going with Ireland? Things is going well?
It's grand. It's a hobby, really, for the likes of yourself. You wrote a very good paper using some of the data, right? Looking at the relationship between the media and public opinion on the Apple tax. That was really good.
Cool. Yeah, well, I really enjoyed it. But listen, Kevin, so we're going to talk about social class and what it means, how relevant it is, how to measure it, how to think about it,
yeah,
and to what extent it is shaping Irish voting behavior, and to what extent it's shaping Irish politics. We've kind of had different views on this in the past. We've had good debates about it, so hopefully we'll get a bit of a conversation debate going here for our listeners. But you've kind of changed your view on social class in the past while, I presume, from looking at the data. Why is that, Kevin?
All right. So, changed my view. Right. So, I'd say the biggest thing is that the recent general election, right, has shown how in Ireland there's a very clear division that some polls immediately after the election did show was falling along class lines, working class and middle class lines. And there's absolutely no doubt that there is a difference between Sinn Féin voters and Fine Gael voters in terms of their income and class, perhaps as a function of income. I have issues with class in general. I think it comes from a kind of a statistician's definitional sense, you know, that it's something that was there and arrived. It was mainly in the UK, I guess, in coming from working class and middle class and defined by whether your occupation involved manual or non-manual labor.
Yeah.
But deep down below that, like, that has nothing to do with whether you use your hands or not in terms of your job. Doesn't really actually mean much, right? Unless it's connected to something beneath it. And historically speaking, my understanding is that it was connected to wealth and opportunity. So, like, if you were just using your hands basically to do stuff rather than, say, your head, then I guess it's coming from a position where you're less likely to kind of move up the kind of, you're less likely to gain wealth. And nowadays, education is a much better predictor of money behavior in lots of countries, because education, higher levels of education reflect that mobility, I guess, that people have. And I definitely got into a lot of trouble, not just with you, Hayden, but also in the UK around the British Labour Party, where, you know, I wrote a piece in The Guardian giving out about class, about how Labour had this kind of obsession with class, you know, that it needed to kind of adapt to the new working world, because there were issues with class as a definition. If you look at class as a definition, it's quite limited. Like, you know, there's much better ways of trying to divide up the population using like people's behaviors and attitudes to try to figure out what are the real subsets. Like, take the recent US election, right? If you were to look simply at class or income even, actually Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton's voters weren't very different at all in terms of that simple definition. But if you break it down into, say, white, non-college, working class males, then there's a massive difference. But that's just because the populations are much more complex. Like, what we used to do in the Labour Party is we'd take a whole low range of behaviors, attitudes, demographics, and all that sort of stuff, and use a thing called cluster analysis to form groups within society that were kind of homogenous. So, you know, there's people who will watch documentaries, and then there are people who will watch soaps. There are people who will shop in Lidl, and people who will shop in, say, in Ireland, say, Supervalu. Yeah. And there's these patterns of behavior and attitudes that, if you allow the data itself to form these groups, those groups themselves are actually quite different from our understanding of manual versus non-manual labor. And one of the problems in the UK was that people were focusing too much on class when then there was really other things going on. I mean, talking about like reopening the mines and that sort of stuff has nothing to do with these differences in these societies. So like, it's not like people are, you know.
But at the same time, as you say, income and education are very, very powerful predictors of voting behavior. And it's not that income and education are uncorrelated to our concept of class. But it seems to me, and I would look at this kind of from the more comparative political economy literature, which would suggest kind of the following way to think about it. That, you know, we've had all these structural changes in the economy brought about by globalization, to put it simply. The structural impact of globalization, the opening up of markets, the liberalization of trade, capital, free movement of people, goods and services, Europeanization, you know, has led to big structural changes in the labor market and the work that people do. So I think we're on the same page that the kind of traditional, you know, classic functionalist, Marxist even analyses of working class, manual, you know, and then everybody else in effect, right? But I think most people would agree that those kind of simple definitions don't really apply, at least in terms of measurement. But you've had these changes in the labor market.
Yeah,
and the big and obvious change has been that there's a growth in service-based employment. I mean, services make up 80% of jobs now today, right? In all advanced capitalist democracies. But as we know, services is a very broad term that captures a lot of very different jobs. And within that 80% of services, you have public sector jobs, public services, healthcare, education, working for local governments. You've got civil society, NGOs. You know, you've got private market services in technology, in finance, in accounting, in legal services. You've got lower paid services in terms of personal care work, in terms of retail, in terms of security. So clearly it's a very diverse group. And then you do have kind of production work, which would typically be your manual work, as you're getting at, which is routine-based work, which made up effectively 35, sometimes 40% of employment in certain kind of capitalist economies in the 70s when the kind of classic concepts of class existed. But having said all that, you know, Production work would include people who work in industry, you know, who work in construction. And it's true, they typically tend to be male jobs, right? But the big change that comes with service-based employment, obviously, is the growth of women in the labor force as well. That's the other big qualitative shift. But the work that I would be familiar with and research I would do, which takes a kind of economic sociology type analysis of class, yeah, would suggest that actually, despite all these big changes and despite the kind of complexity, there's still a pattern there, and that manifests itself in terms of voting behavior, whereby typically higher educated workers will work in public services or private market services, for simplest purpose, let's say health, education, ICT, finance. Those kind of cohort of voters would share very similar views, preferences, values, and attitudes on social policies. They'd be socially liberal. They'd be tolerant of immigration, very tolerant very supportive of LGBT rights, women's rights, etc. So that kind of cleavage is important, as we know, in Western Europe, right? And we can talk about that. Yeah. And then but they also have very different views on the economy, right? Typically, public sector workers are lower income or what the literature would call socio-cultural professionals. They will be lower income than private market service workers, who will be higher income. And actually, the income difference between them often shapes their left-right preferences on the economy. So you have one group that's left on the economy, left on cultural questions, one group that's kind of more right on the economy, but left liberal on cultural questions. Then we could talk about, what about everybody else? What about the precarious, the lower paid service workers plus industrial production workers? And it seems to me on that basis, it's not entirely clear. The research does show that production workers tend to be left on the economy, centrist, if not conservative on social questions, whereas precarious workers are often higher educated but lower income, left on lit questions, and share very similar views to kind of social cultural professionals. So you have four different kind of groupings, if you like. And the question is that social class? Or because it seems to me when you talk about social class, you're kind of talking about something slightly different, right? You're talking about it, I think, in a more cultural way.
Certainly that definitional sense is the one thing I sometimes have an issue with. Because I guess when you're coming back to doing polling and analysis and presenting information, now people want to have the words working class and middle class, and they want to divide the public into simplified categories.
Yeah.
The thing that I would always argue is it's actually very difficult to measure those things unless, like, we know that the manual, non-manual thing is complete nonsense now, right?
Yeah.
So how do we replace that? One example is, I think we were talking about this, Leo Carella and Rob Ford have this paper on stats, and they're very basically borrowing a mechanism which takes... it takes who people's best friend, like what the occupational title of your best friend is, right? And they link all these occupational titles together to get a unidimensional, kind of a single scale of who's at the top of society and who's at the bottom. By linking these kind of who's your best friend and what they do, and they find that correlates with support for, say, UKIP, where... and class didn't, so let's say. And that thing is kind of that. And its basis, that is kind of the way of kind of saying, let's try and see how occupation fits at all into this system. And the way in which it seems to, via this kind of mechanism, is this, it's a sense of perceived social value. So like the likes of lecturers and academics and stuff are relatively high up on that scale because they have this perceived social value. Teachers are relatively high up, even though teachers, normally speaking, based on their income and wealth, actually have kind of fallen down, relatively speaking. So it's that kind of perspective of looking at it, like, let's just, like, because this thing is no longer easy to measure, and that's partly because of, you know, you're talking about the increased service economy and changes in what's called, like, job inflation, you know, when someone who just puts down their job title as a manager, and you don't know whether they're a manager like earning an enormous amount or earning relatively little, whether they have manager in a role where, you know, they have lots of subordinates or whether they don't, and all that sort of stuff. And you end up in these polls, people asking questions like, how many holidays did you take and how many subordinates you have, to try to find another way of linking occupation to our predefined notion of class. And I think class in some way if it's about capital and wealth, well, why not ask them, like, what their income is, how much their house is, how much is their house worth, you know, that sort of stuff. And their education, which those three things really capture, I think, the essence of what class was intended to be. After that, I would say that I wouldn't disagree that there aren't classes of people in society. Like, I remember doing this this analysis in lots of different countries. Exactly as you say, you typically end up with five groups, basically. If you do a cluster analysis and just throw everything from political science out, right? One group is your small C conservative, right? They're not actually right-wing ideologically. They're just cautious by their very nature. They don't like the idea of the left and the ideology of the left. They're kind of like your 50-plus-year-old, relatively center-ground, but they might also go center-right because... And they're just cautious, small C conservatives. That's the first group. They typically vote for the center-right or the government. Your second group is the anti-immigrant party. I mean, that's the best way to define them because that's the variable that kind of over-indexes the most. The best question is whether you think the government is being too generous or not in relation to refugees. And it's just always in there like a light on top of the typical populist questions of, like, do you trust politicians and that sort of stuff. That's the second group. The third group is the environmentalist group, which tends to be pro-immigration as a response to the anti-immigration group, which is also anti-environmentalist in response to the pro-environmental group. So those two groups are just playing off each other. Yeah. The environmentalist group is left-wing, but also the highest educated, the highest earning group. And it's not that big, but it dominates public discourse and political discourse in a way. Like, I remember I did a recent survey of Irish people to ask them, were they active on Twitter? And whether they had, how many followers they had on Twitter. And what was interesting was that kind of centre-left grouping of the Soc Dems, Labour and Greens tend to have lots of followers if they're on Twitter, whereas the Sinn Féin people, when they're on Twitter, they tend to have very few followers. And it's just because the people that tend to be in Labour, Green or Soc Dems tend to be, in terms of this high status stuff, relatively high income, basically.
Yeah. Economically secure, job secure, urban, liberal, metropolitan.
All that stuff, yeah. And it's so cohesive. Like, no matter how many countries you do this in, it's always, I mean, Ireland's slightly different, right? But it's always the same sort of group. And I've no doubt it will emerge in Ireland with this kind of an anti-immigrant group will emerge in this pro-immigrant group. They just feed off each other.
Yeah.
So they're the three most obviously distinctive groups. And then you have these two other groups that you just won't hear much about because they don't turn up at the polls. They don't turn up in folk polls either, and they don't really appear much of anywhere else. The one which will be particularly poor, very low incomes, no interest in politics. Politics, to be fair, has probably done very little for them. They typically don't vote, but have some tendency to vote or whatever. And then there's the last group, which is just completely disaffected. And sometimes they're kind of libertarian types. They're kind of sometimes just anti-government in a general sense, basically. But those two last groups typically don't vote. And so the real contest is always between the anti-immigrant group, the pro-immigrant group, and the small C conservatives. And, I remember our hopefully you can say this, but like our thing with, say, the German Greens was that they had to tack towards the small C conservatives to kind of increase their support and kind of talk about conservationism.
Yeah.
And to appeal to that kind of innate cautiousness of those people.
The interesting thing is, though, like, you know, what you just said there is very consistent, even with the books and research that were published as early as the early 90s, right? Or even the late 80s. I'm thinking here about the work by Herbert Kitchelt and others, you know, about the kind of social democracy. And they were all pointing out that there's two cleavages, two dimensions emerging in terms of shaping voter behavior and party choice and party competition. Yeah. And, you know, we see now today, less so in Ireland, and we should probably tease that out because I'd be curious to hear whether you think that will be the case going forward, but at least right across Western Europe, this kind of very clear conflict between green, liberal, economically secure cultural professionals and kind of far right anti-immigrant, again, depending on the country, typically not necessarily lower income, often higher income, but less formal education, and typically were living in rural areas. And that's you even see it, for example, in the recent, you probably know, the regional elections, the local elections in Germany last week, whereby the Greens, the Green-Red Alliance, in effect, or mainly the Green Alliance, swept up in the cities. And there's and in the cities, the kind of divide is between the Christian Democrats and the Greens, in effect. And then rurally, you know, in East Germany, you obviously have the AfD, Alternative for Deutschland. You've seen it in Austria, you see it in Amsterdam. And there's a lot to be said for that. We don't have it here. And my view would be it's because, let me take it slightly different. Like Sinn Féin mobilized.
Classic Ono Mali argument.
Well, see, I disagree slightly with that argument. So I'll tell you what I. To kind of, and again, this is, I have Ono Mali's piece, and this is really excellent.
Not really being
research brilliant on this. And my take on it is slightly different. I don't think Sinn Féin are just a functional equivalent of the radical right. That, you know, you have Sinn Féin and you have the radical right. No, I think there is something qualitatively different about Sinn Féin. They are a left populist party, and they focus and put the weight on fiscal economic issues, and they have politicized the economy in such a way that they're adopting, in effect, the kind of classic social democratic strategy, which is building a coalition between low to middle income earners, regardless of their educational level, by focusing on economic issues. Now, you could argue, and many people would argue, that it's only a matter of time before immigration becomes a high salient issue. And when it does, or if it does, Sinn Féin will be in trouble at that point in time. But it's not a salient issue. It just isn't. And you know this from the data, and it's really remarkable why it's not a salient issue in the Irish case.
That's
not to say that there's loads of anti-immigrant far-right. Of course there are. I'm not saying it doesn't exist. It does. But it's not showing up as a high salient issue in terms of electoral politics.
No, there's so many different things to talk about there. I'm going to start about the populist sort of stuff. I mean, the one guy who I really like using his work is a guy called Jonathan Haidt. He comes up with this thing with the, you know, you probably hear about the big five personality traits, right, and all that sort of stuff. That's garbage as far as I'm concerned in relation to voting behavior, because that's like the Cambridge Analytica stuff was big five. And it's nonsense, because if you were to do that quiz, let's say, over and over, you'll find that you're not coming up with consistent answers whatsoever.
Right.
The thing that's much better is Jonathan Haidt's five channels of moral psychology. I think he's added a six, because the weakness of it was this kind of libertarianism perspective. But the central idea in that is that there are two people on the left focus on the first two channels, and people who are on the right condition those first two based on the other three. So the first two are called like protection or care, and the second one is called fairness. So the idea that the priority should be to protect the vulnerable and to make sure that things are fair between people. And that's the left perspective. The right perspective is that it conditions on those two things, these three other factors, which are loyalty, so in-group loyalty, which you see in lots of countries around immigration and that sort of stuff, authority, so adherence to the authoritarian perspective, so are the people in power, you know, right in general about things, and purity, which is a much more kind of religious sort of aspect to, you know, how strict should we be about personal liberties and that sort of stuff. Like one question that comes into that, which is about like banning pornography and that sort of stuff. And some of the best questions to try to pull these things out are when you ask people how their kids should be treated. Should they respect authority, or should they be taught clear manners, or should you kind of feel it out a little bit? And that's a great way of trying to pull apart these different things. But that psychological component is so consistent in support for the right more generally than the left. And it's, I think one of the reasons why this is kind of bubbling up is because class itself and those distinctions in terms of wealth and income have kind of fallen a little bit. Like, let's exclude the kind of top 5% from all this, but there's like a kind of wider and middle, lower middle class nowadays. People,
yeah.
There's a very, very large group of people with relatively lower incomes, I guess.
Yeah.
And because all these people are the same, then it's coming down to how is their makeup of their brain? Is it associated with a whole stream of different ideas that are almost instinctive that push them into the left, or is it instinctive to push them into the right? And in that sense, the loyalty thing, I think, is a feature around internal urban migration. So in the midst of the 2009 recession, a lot of these kind of towns, a lot of people left those towns and went into the big cities. And what determined your decision, whether you wanted to stay at home with your kind of local community or whether you wanted to kind of, you know, pull yourself up and go to the big city and focus on getting a career. And
yeah.
That distinctive difference, I think, is more innate than we might think. And I think that drove a bit of a difference. One of the first things I found about when I was analyzing the 2016 Trump thing was one of the best predictors of whether an area was going to vote for Trump or Clinton was based on the rate of change of the population of that area, much yeah. more so than the ethnicity, level of education or anything like that. If the population had decreased significantly from one census to the next, it was far more likely to vote for Donald Trump. And it was a very strong linear relationship. And it was also replicated in the Brexit sort of referendum. Places like Ashfield, where the population is in stark decline, or on Bolsover, are places where the Tories have rocketed, basically. And in contrast, places like Brighton and Bolton West, or Bristol West, are places where the Labour Party and the kind of left perspective have started to dominate. Because essentially what you've seen in this recession is an enormous amount of migration, urban migration into these areas. And what you're then seeing now in the UK is some migration out of the cities into kind of the hinterlands of London, where Labour have started to kind of start pick up. That's kind of on the populist aspect, which is about that kind of contrast of... Another thing, actually, just on top of that, is I remember we did a focus group of people in Manchester. They were kind of on the outskirts of Manchester. They were former Labour, but current UKIP voters. And we're trying to tease out why did they decide to go to UKIP. And obviously, after a while, they kind of start talking about immigration and they start talking about refugees and their local community. Initially, the conversation talks about the economics of the situation, that the refugees are coming in, taking our jobs. They're talking in a macro sense. They're saying, like, yeah. housing lists, it's more difficult to kind of get on the housing list. Now, these are people who already had a house. So that wasn't a clear reason for them personally. And I've always found that you have to go deeper and deeper into their personal, emotional, their personal history and the emotional impact of those things. And if you go deeper, I think one of the reasons why they focus on the economy is because we always talk about the economy. Mm-hmm. You know, ever since, what's his face, talk about it's the economy, stupid. And because, you know, 40% of people, when they're asked about what's the most important issue, they typically will say it's the economy or whatever, because it's the right answer to give, you know. But for a lot of these people who have stayed in these towns, who have a loyalty to those towns, it's clearly not the economy that's holding them in those towns. It's clearly that something else. And so when you dig deeper, they always talk about, they go to the local shop and the person in the shop is, you know, not of their yeah. and it's this
language to them or whatever.
It's the community thing that they feel that they're missing. And when they're walking down the street, they feel that they can't have that relationship. They're incredibly upset if anyone would call them racist, because that kind of idea where that they should be a pillar of the local community is very important. But it's all wrapped in that sense of community. And I guess in Ireland, one of the reasons why I think why we've managed to avoid the rise of the far right, I think there's a couple of reasons. One is, well, we've had kind of the strength of the GAA to kind of be able to maintain cohesive communities in Ireland, where in the UK it really hasn't. I mean, football has been central to those communities. Now football is a commercial enterprise, and it's very different. We've had in our politics independence. I know people mentioned Sinn Féin as being a home for people who would otherwise vote for the far right, but actually quite a lot of the people who would be anti-immigrant or in relation to that particular question about refugees, they would tend towards independent candidates.
Yeah.
And I think it's all linked to that sense of community, because the independent candidates are the ones who are talking about the local area the most. It's all within that sort of sphere of influence. And just to move on to the next bit around Ireland, I mean, the UCD Ireland Thinks survey we did obviously an exit poll on the day, asked people, gave them a ballot basically online. It was a group of people that we had gathered earlier on, so it was a representative sample. And they were asked online to fill out the ballot. So we knew it would be relatively accurate, because what happens after an election is sometimes people kind of back the winner. So people say that they voted Sinn Féin, but they didn't. You know? And asked a range of questions and demographics, you know, age, education, religion, gender, income, a whole load of attitudes about immigration, United Ireland, the environment, corruption, inequality, left, right, all of this sort of stuff.
I put them all.
Yeah, everything. And that was the same method we did for all these European countries. Just like, let's throw the kitchen sink at this and see what makes those voters different. What is different about the Sinner vote? And this comes back to your question at the start, why have I changed my tune? the Sinn Féin vote, right? When you look at all those things, you know, and ask people, why are you voting for Sinn Féin? And how is that Sinn Féin voter different from everywhere else? They're different because their perception of the government's performance is very bad. You might think, well, that's what any opposition party would do, but actually people who voted for other opposition parties didn't have that perception. Yeah. Obviously, Fine Gael thought the government was very good or good, but Fianna Fáil voters were most likely to say that one of the things that is distinctive about the Fianna Fáil voter is that they don't know whether the government was good or bad.
Yeah.
And like, they're just like in the middle, not really taking a side. And I think that was quite problematic. Labour as well was more likely to say that they didn't know as well. The other things about Sinn Féin, the top characteristics were that they were left-wing. Their perception of the economy was really strong. This is where it comes back to your expertise as well. People are asked, do you think the economy has gone better or worse? Obviously, Sinn Féin voters, because they think the government has done a very bad job, will probably associate that with that. But another question is known as the pocketbook question, which you probably well know about, of course, as well. But it's just about, has your economic situation got worse or better in the last year? And that is one of the things that Sinn Féin dominates completely. People for whom their economic situation got significantly worse, which accounts for a very, very large proportion of the electorate, they voted Sinn Féin pretty much overwhelmingly. The next thing is income. Another thing in the mix of all that, which I found quite interesting, is the perception of corruption.
Yeah.
So people are asked, is corruption very widespread, not widespread at all? And the Sinn Féin voter is more likely to say, much more likely to say, corruption is very widespread. And those things, that perception of the economy, their own personal income, perceptions of corruption, is what's defining that Sinn Féin vote, much more so than all this other stuff on immigration, whatever the hell it is. Those things, that kind of, it's very definitively a left-wing party. That is what Sinn Féin is. It is populist as well. I mean, they're more likely to say they don't trust politicians, and that is a very important feature of all this. But those other features are the biggest. And I'd like to talk a little bit more about the pocketbook and income stuff in a bit, but
let's tease it out in a moment. But before we get up, I mean, for me, there's a pretty clear pattern emerging here. So, you know, one could look at this globally. That is, in terms of kind of the more advanced capitalist democracies, include USA, UK, Western Europe, further afield. But let's just focus in, and you know, there's, and like, where clearly the kind of culture wars and immigration have become more salient and have become a particular cleavage that has shaped kind of party competition and voter conflict. And it's clearly playing itself out in terms of the left being kind of threatened, if you like, by parties to the right and left and taking their kind of core vote, and very difficult to know what to do in response. Ireland obviously being particularly slightly different in this sense, but it's different in the way that you've just outlined, which I think is perhaps even more interesting, because it's not the typical story that we hear, which is that actually when you look at the data, who votes Sinn Féin, as you say, it's a left vote. And it's a left vote because people think or perceive their economic circumstances to be not getting better or getting worse. They're typically on lower incomes. And let's just define lower income here for the listeners. For me, lower income, you know, is low to middle, let's say low to middle, which could be anything below 40,000, which is effectively 70% of the electorate, right? So it's a pretty big group.
Yeah.
It's a pretty big group. And also, as you say, a perception that government has not been performing and that there's more corruption in Irish society and you know, which is probably a function of lack of trust, etc. But put all that together into one mix. And again, people who self-identify also on the left, which we could talk about. But there's a clear pattern there. I suppose what I would wonder is, it seems to me that if your income is not improving and you're paying a lot of money for very poor quality housing and you don't think public services are great, quality of life is not great, you're obviously going to judge the government differently than somebody who's on higher income, very secure, living in a nice big house, you know, and very comfortable, right? Of course you're going to view government differently. So I just wonder, are all these other things that we observe about the kind of the Sinn Féin vote, which has created this kind of clear left-right divide, I think, in Irish politics, with Sinn Féin on the left, Fine Gael on the right, you've got a centre-left urban liberal vote with sort of Greens, Labour, Social Democrats, Fianna Fáil being squeezed on all fronts, and then the kind of independents who are perhaps tipping in that right populist direction, you could argue, right?
Yeah.
But I just wonder, so, you know, when I was looking at the data, if you take all that stuff out, income alone does a lot of the heavy lifting.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Actually, is it worth, can I share a screen?
Yeah, go ahead. Let's do it, yeah. Jack.
All right. So I want to show you something. Host disabled participants here scratching. I think you need to.
I have to enable it here? One second. Let's see.
Yeah. So, like, I want to show you this as a chart, if that's okay.
Yeah, it's not letting me share.
Oh, I have it now. Yeah.
It's showing on the screen, though. That's the only thing. I don't think it is. Oh, wait, it is. Yeah.
There we go. Right. So this is the question I was talking about there. Can you see that, Jim?
Yeah, I can see it perfectly, yeah.
The green bars are the people who thought their economic situation, that they are better off compared to last year. The red are the percentage of people who think that they're worse off. So, yeah, each one is within category. So 37% of Fine Gael voters thought they were better off and 15% thought they were worse off. And it's quite different to the 62% of Sinn Féin voters who think that they are worse off.
It's pretty stark.
And those questions, right, are quite separated. I mean, your own personal evaluation of how your income situation has developed in the last year is quite a separate thing from your political, you know, sometimes these questions can kind of interfere with one another, you know, because someone might change their attitude because, you know, they hate the government or whatever. But, you know, that is so clear. I want to show you this other one, right, which is more on the economic end of things. There we go. Which is, you break this down by income. And, like, whatever people talk about in relation to income inequality in Ireland, I think it's sometimes hard, like, we try and evaluate, well, economists, I guess, try and evaluate that using raw data. But I think it's hard to actually really appreciate the complexity of people's lives. In relation to this, you don't know whether they're able to offset their lower income by going to Lidl as opposed to Supervalu or whatever. You don't know to what extent that is possible. And the individual little decisions that people need to make, to what extent has, like, some loophole closed in welfare or benefits or whatever, How is all that system actually operating together in one? And what is clear from this is that those who are earning lower, who are on lower incomes, feel that their situation has got worse off. Now, obviously, you could say, well, they're worse off because maybe they were higher on up on the income scales. But people don't move around that much.
I mean, Kevin, just so I can explain. So basically, what we're looking at here, the green bar is those who say they are better off. The red bar is those who say they've been worse off economically. And on the horizontal axis, it goes from those who have less than 10,000, 10 to 20, 20 to 40, 40 to 60, 60 to 80, and over 80,000 euros. And it's obvious that those who have income of less than 10, less than 20, basically those who have income between 10 to 60, identify or say that the situation is that is worse off.
Yeah.
That's pretty stark.
Yeah, it is. It's stark. I mean, these three charts, this chart and the last one, and then obviously the one which would show the relationship between income and voting behavior, they're just very clear. You know what I mean? I mean,
And in the sense,
they're getting 45% of those who are better off. And Sinn Féin are only getting 7% of them, you know. Sinn Féin are getting 39%, Fine Gael's 8% of those that are worse off. It's clear that this feature is driving quite a lot. And that income isn't obviously perfect. You know, I've talked a lot about how you need to combine different measures to try to get a sense of the different groups in society. But this sort of stuff doesn't appear in other European countries. You don't find income driving it to this extent. It will certainly pull out one or two of those smaller groups of people who are generally disaffected. And broadly speaking, the Sinn Féin voter they are getting a much larger proportion of people who don't pay as much interest to politics. And perhaps they're bringing those people in, and those people are now voting when they haven't before, because there is a party that identifies, that is easily identifiable as the party for, in rough terms, the working class, I guess.
So the interesting thing here, Kevin, is, so what you've just shown there, what we're talking about, it's not really the story that you hear more broadly in Irish public life, where I could be completely wrong about this and maybe blinkered and, you know, identifying things or patterns that, you know, are not necessarily there more broadly. But it seems to me that the narrative is everything has been great. You know, things are really improving. The economy is fantastic. And on a macro level, it kind of is. And it seems to me that a lot of the problems that we observe in the Irish data is that you have this GDP macro figure, which is really capturing one economy within Ireland, which is the kind of multinational economy, and then the economy that everybody else lives in. And when I say the multinational economy, I don't just mean those who work in the big tech, big pharma companies. I mean those who service those as well, often in the legal services, accounting services, financial services. So there is a cohort, let's say, of 15, maybe even let's say 20%, the top quintile of earners who probably are in that 60 to 80, probably in the 80 plus bracket, actually, for the most part, who are doing really well, and who can afford a mortgage, and who can buy a house, and all the rest that goes with it. And I just wonder whether, you just said, which is true, that this income variable is not doing a lot of explanation in other countries, right, in other European countries, nor in the UK or even the USA.
Nothing like this.
But it is Ireland. And I just think what is distinctive about Ireland is also its economy. Right, it has this kind of foreign direct investment multinational economy, which is very different to what other countries have. And also there's cost of living impacts to all of this too, because housing, I would imagine, is the biggest cost facing pretty much every household, whether you're renting from social housing, whether you're renting privately, whether you're paying a mortgage. It's typically the biggest part of your income that you spend every month.
You spoke at the start of this about how this isn't really featuring in the public debate. And I think that's the thing that's sort of got me recently. You know, I kind of see this and instinctively you see the public debate, public discourse. And at the back of my mind always is this feature, this fact that there's a whole subset of the population that isn't really getting a much of a look in. That's why I started doing that poll to see who's on Twitter, who has influence on Twitter. Twitter is a reflection of society. The people who have lots of followers on that platform are people at the higher end. I mean, that's the truth. The people at the lower end of the economic or status scale, as we might think of it, don't have much influence. I want to pull out this other thing, right? Which is, can you see that?
Yeah, I can. Yep. This is the
this is wrapping around again. Do you remember we were talking at the start about how Channon Goldthorpe, well, we're talking about the paper written by Rob Ford and Leo Carella, which was called around status. And they basically took occupational titles and they looked at who people's best friends were to look at, to try to redefine class in these terms, to say, like, let's allow the data to determine class itself. And Channon Goldthorpe are the people that actually did it. And these are the categories that they have. And this is the status, right? And to my mind, the issue is that the people at the lower end of this status kind of ranking, let's say, the general laborers, the plant and machine operatives, transport operators, manual workers, catering workers, protective service personnel, health workers, sales, those people aren't really getting much of a look in terms of discourse. And it's probably the people at the top end who probably are. And that might be what's going on here in terms of the fact that this is this kind of hidden component which is driving things in different directions. I think it's hard to ignore that kind of public discourse role in all this. The most recent obvious example was this latest, and I've talked a lot about this in other places, about the rally around the flags, how when opposition parties suddenly don't really criticize the government anymore, then support for the government in terms of the party increases. And we saw that happen in every country in Europe, basically, around COVID. When there was a kind of a we're all in it together, support for the government increases. Some people say it's a function of fear and people looking for leaders and all that sort of stuff as well. But it also seems to be around public criticism. Another aspect of this recently was around Brexit. So whenever Brexit was discussed in Ireland, there was a kind of an agreement maybe between the parties that there was no real criticism of the government's position on Brexit. And so every time there was a crunch point in the Brexit negotiations, Fine Gael typically jumped a little bit in the polls. I mean, it was November 2017, and I think it was the following December, that they had this kind of lift, which was almost entirely Brexit related, because that was dominating the airwaves. And I think what happened in the recent election, I mean, I've been tracking open-ended, what is the most important issue people see in terms of politics in Ireland. And for 2 years and a half, maybe it was, Brexit had like 25% of people would mention Brexit as an important issue. When the British general election happened in late 2019 and Brexit was effectively done, according to Boris Johnson at least, it completely depoliticized the issue and it was no longer a salient issue. And I would attribute, if I was to pick anything, I would attribute the fall in support for Fine Gael to that. Because at that point, the salience of healthcare and other issues started to rise and the focus of people back on their support for a particular party being dependent on domestic affairs. The bread and butter stuff started to dominate again. And I think that's how Sinn Féin emerged almost overnight in January. So between December and January, that's when Sinn Féin increased their vote.
There was also that issue, if you recall, wasn't it, that the centenary around, what was it again? Something about
Black and Tans.
Yeah, the Black and Tans thing. Like, that was a serious, but I think that was a serious own goal by Fine Gael. And I think it reflects actually something similar to what you were saying here. You know, clearly that resonated with people. They didn't like it. And they didn't like it not because they're some sort of raving nationalists. They didn't like it because they've got their ABC junior cert history and they know what Black and Tan stands for in their mind. And the perception that Fine Gael were somehow going to kind of take a slightly revisionist approach to this clearly irked people. And I think it really, for me, it revealed quite frankly, a certain out-of-touch dimension that, you know, Sinn Féin were able to highlight once again that the establishment is out of touch with what people feel and think about these issues, you know?
Well, yeah, I mean, certainly at the start of January, I think both parties rose, really. Like, Fianna Fáil also kind of jumped in the polls as well, but then they had a terrible campaign. Over that period in which Fianna Fáil just generally just went down over time. And I think that's a function of the fact that they didn't know whether they were for the government or against the government, because they were part in and part out. And their voters, as you saw in that thing, like, they dominated the area of people who just didn't know or against government. And the only other thing Fianna Fáil voters were kind of significant on, really, was that issue of corruption, which has kind of, just something that's interested me recently, because I haven't quite reconciled it, and that Fianna Fáil voters were more likely to think that corruption hardly happens at all. In the complete contrast to Sinn Féin. Again, bringing it back to the psychology thing, I am kind of leaning towards the idea that that might be part of, Jonathan Haidt's five channels, in which, like, adherence to authority, the idea that authority could perhaps be corrupt in any way, might vary, you know. And the most recent example was like the Phil Hogan thing. How, you know, it was clearly going to trigger a massive response from certain voters.
But am I correct in also saying, Kevin, in the data, when the only social group that had a higher probability of voting Fianna Fáil, or maybe this is just in the opinion polls, not so much in the 2020 survey, but I think it is indeed the case, were over 60s church-going Catholics.
Yeah, that has definitely been a feature of the Fianna Fáil.
That doesn't really bode well for the future of Fianna Fáil when you acknowledge that effectively, I think even as in the early 90s, almost 80% of people went to mass on a monthly basis or more. Today, it's about 30%. I think in the early 90s, 5% of people said they never went to mass. Today, it's like over 50%. So, you know, it's not a growing constituency, let's say.
No, you're right. And there's two things to say there. One was, I mean, I remember we did the How Ireland Voted chapter on how people are voting and all that sort of stuff. And at the start of doing that, my premise was going to be, well, the repeal of the 8th and the introduction of the 8th Amendment kind of bookend a period, a very linear trend in which the Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael vote very steadily has declined. And education, third level education has steadily increased. home ownership has changed steadily as well over that period. There's a whole lot of different things that have kind of changed. And education and religion, obviously, is probably the biggest one as well, have changed, bookended by that period, that kind of 40 years, I guess, since 1980. That exact period, and I was focused initially on that kind of those things, saying, well, there's this undercurrent of features that lend themselves towards support for left-wing parties. Younger, higher educated, less likely to be religious, and all that sort of stuff. As it has transpired, that doesn't seem to dominate. To some extent, you're absolutely right that, like, if you think of the electorate as a quadrant between age and education, are the best two, and high educate older people with a third level degree are more likely to vote Fine Gael above any other party.
Yeah,
older people without a third level are more likely to vote Fianna Fáil as opposed to any other party. Higher education, younger people are more likely to vote Soc Dems / Greens / Labour, and then lower education, younger people are more likely to vote for Sinn Féin.
Yeah.
But that is true, but the extent to which that explains it is limited, right?
Yeah.
This other stuff, this income stuff, is bigger. Like, you could look at any graph in terms of voting behavior, you can see a difference between parties, but it's always like, what is the biggest difference? What is the big kahuna here? And it's like, it's income. Like, it's
totally
to be this thing. And this is the reason why I had that income and pocketbook evaluation thing, is that to me tells a story that isn't being covered by the economists. That there's something else missing in their analysis of inequality in Ireland and Gini coefficients and all that sort of stuff.
But even, but Kevin, even when you talk about income inequality or wealth inequality in Ireland, and I've been doing a bit of work on this with Micheál Collins from UCD, and he's really the, kind of the expert on the detailed kind of silk data, the survey on income and living conditions. But even more, even when you talk about income inequality in Ireland, generally speaking, and again, this is not to kind of caricature or set up a straw man, generally speaking, the kind of louder voices from, you know, the kind of economic commentary will very quickly come in and point out just how things have improved, how earnings have gone up, and they'll use a variety of different measures to kind of strip out income, just look at earnings, actually things are great and so on. And, you know, as you say, the picture that's presented is, Jesus, we should all be bloody delighted, you know. Housing costs haven't gone up that much because we measured this way and that way and this way and that way, etc. But none of it is capturing, I think, what we know, what we see, which is clearly there is a qualitative experience that people are having. That their income is not matching their expectations in terms of the type of lifestyle that they want to live. And that's not a feeling that's widely shared. There are some people who are doing well and most people who are not.
Yeah, I think that's the issue. And it's, I don't know what other data needs to be explored, why this is that people think that they're much worse off on these lower incomes. There must be something that is missing. Maybe it's the classification. You were talking earlier about how the incomes are distributed and how people look at quintiles and that sort of stuff. And perhaps that's not the way to look at it, of how maybe you take the bottom 50 and then
yes.
I think you were talking about that the other day.
Well, I think my own view is certainly that, so we could talk about, for example, social class, and we could get into a cultural debate and a kind of economic sociology debate and a measurement question, and we could get down in the weeds in terms of occupational classifications and the ILO labor ISCO codes, and we could be here all day talking about it. But we kind of know that anybody who lives in Dublin, there is a housing distinction, there's an education distinction. People go to different and similar schools and different and attend different and similar educational institutions and so on. It's not as deeply class divided culturally as it is in the UK, but it's there. And anybody who doesn't acknowledge that, you know, doesn't spend enough time walking around, quite frankly. But all that aside, if you were to adopt a more kind of what I view to be a bit more systematic approach to analyzing this in terms of voting behavior and identification in terms of whether or not class matters in terms of voting competition and electoral competition and party competition, taking the 50-40-10 split will do a lot of explanations for you. That is, the bottom 50% of the income distribution, the middle 40, the top 10, and within the top 10, the top 1%. And in a sense, it's a bit like, you know, that kind of matches on to people's intuitive sense of working middle and upper class, you know. But it's not entirely mapping, because obviously everybody pretty much below the top 0.5% of the income distribution work for a living, in the sense of they earn a wage or they have earnings. So, you know, wealth becomes important in terms of your access to assets and the income you can generate from that. So we could talk a lot about the influence of the capital owning class, which is typically those who own financial assets at the very, very peak and pinnacle of the income distribution, which ironically, not that ironically, but interestingly in Ireland, also overlaps quite heavily with the kind of big finance accounting professions and legal professions. But the 50-40-10 split, I think, does a lot of the explanation. Sinn Féin are anchored in the bottom 50%. Fine Gael are anchored in the top 10%. And parties compete in many ways for that kind of left of centrist vote within the middle 40. And as you say, that can go pretty much any way. So it leads to all sorts of different permutations in terms of party politics and coalitions. But for me, the two anchors and the left-right divide is clearly between Sinn Féin and Fine Gael.
Yeah, I wanted to, I don't know if you can see my screen there.
Yeah.
Can you? Yeah.
The screen that you have up with the slides, yes.
Oh, you can see the slides. Okay, hold on a sec. I might just show you another one. Let me see. Hold on one second.
Just as you were doing that, I mean, I'll just continue slightly.
Yeah, do, yeah.
What I find interesting about all of that, and we have touched on it a moment ago, is that that kind of explanation doesn't match that well onto what's happening in other Western European countries. So, you know, for those who are interested in kind of what's happening more broadly in Europe, this is less the case. And it could be that people's incomes actually just travel farther and people have more economic security. And therefore, the weight is the salience of that issue is less prevalent. Or it could be that it's got nothing to do actually with the demand side of politics. It's just that Sinn Féin as a party have strategized and mobilized on these issues and therefore have made it a more salient issue. Whereas if they had a focus on other issues, maybe it wouldn't be as high a salient issue, which says a lot about the kind of mediating effect of political parties themselves in creating new political dynamics and conflicts in society.
Can you see that?
Yeah, can. Yeah, just make it bigger.
Ooh. So this is the income thing.
Oh, yeah. Okay, great. Yeah.
Actually, that's a bit fuzzy, isn't it? That's, hold on, that's the wrong way around. Sorry. Let me just show values of the percentage of row.
I mean, what I find interesting there, if I'm reading that correctly, is that the cohort of people's, the income group that are most popular in terms of Sinn Féin voters are actually those who are earning between 20 and 40 grand, is that?
No, so that's just because that's the biggest group. That was just taking it as a percentage the other way around. So this is showing it as, can you see
maybe,
that?
Maybe put your full screen on, Kevin.
Oh yeah. Right, you tell
it. Yeah.
So this is just showing vote share broken down by income. So the first bar in each set, so you see there's one that says Fine Gael and you've got 10% on the far left. So that's basically saying that Fine Gael have 10% of the vote among those earning less than 10,000. Whereas Sinn Féin have 33%, if you see the corresponding first bar for Sinn Féin on the right-hand side. And you can see how the relationship, obviously the sample size starts to kind of waver a little bit. So you see a little bit more volatility in this. But broadly speaking, you can see that the Fine Gael vote is strongly correlated with income. Like the more you earn, the more likely you are to vote for Fine Gael. And then on the other hand, Sinn Féin vote really collapses around 60 grand. Yeah. But it comes back to your point around the 50%, 50-20 or whatever.
Yeah.
And there's the differences between less than 10 to 20, and to some extent 20 to 40 isn't actually that big. It's just that those that are on 60 plus are quite different, I guess.
So it's
a kind of fat lower middle class.
Yeah. And in a sense, that's a kind of a class, like Ireland in a sense is looking like a real stereotypical story of kind of globalization, whereby, you know, the gains that come from it effectively mean that the top quintile, right, if you pull away from the rest, that is the top 20% of the income distribution really begin to move forward. And that often is, of course, increasingly concentrated in cities and metro. And I think that was, you see it in the UK, I mean, you know the British case very, very well. That there is a long tail of lower earners and then this peak at the very top.
Yeah, there's the income distribution and how skewed it is. Yeah, so it's very distinctive how, I mean, in some sense, the less than 10,000 and to some extent 10 to 20,000 can be a little bit influenced. There'll be bits and pieces of people in there who will be like homemakers, especially someone who's relatively high income. This isn't household income. Because household income has its own issues with it when you're asking an individual respondent to estimate the household. So, and because you have students as well living with their parents, you know, what's their household income? So, and you'll have students in that less than 10,000. That's why the Sock Dems and the Green Party doing relatively well.
Yeah.
Particular among in those groups, but the Greens, in a very European sense, are doing much better among those in higher income groups.
That's just
quite what you'd normally see. I think actually Fine Gael have done relatively well in kind of certainly Leo Varadkar has probably pulled off quite a lot of that kind of liberal vote as well.
Yeah.
you know, for a party that would previously have been associated with, you know, being a little more conservative, I guess.
It's I mean, when I was an undergraduate student, Fine Gael were the kind of still the conservative nationalist party. So, you know, there's certainly been a transformation, which is very interesting from a party politics kind of scholarly perspective, that a party that would have been traditionally conservative centre-right have kind of refashioned themselves to become a liberal centre-right party in a relatively short space of time.
Yeah.
Whether their members or voters have moved in the same, as quickly in the same direction is debatable, but I think
if you go back to that metric where we were trying to pull all these variables and throw it at the parties, like, I mean, Sinn Féin was the most distinctive and Fine Gael was just as distinctive as they were. I mean, the Fine Gael voter was just the opposite. You know, the government was doing a very good job. Salaries over 80K, salaries over 60K. Trust politicians strongly was actually
on the trend.
And that's the kind of populism question. So, you know, there is a populist left. There is missing picture there in terms of what you would normally see, a very cohesive group of an anti-immigration party. You're talking about this earlier. I mean, if you look at Ireland in terms of that classic question, is the government too generous with refugees? Ireland's not that different, you know, in terms of the number of people that think that. So there is definitely an issue there, and how they emerge or how they don't emerge, that is like a big question. I think there are differences of opinion on how to tackle and how to avoid immigration becoming a salient issue, because it's a nasty thing when it becomes salient. Like it dominates all else, because it appeals directly to those psychological characteristics. I think it's that loyalty versus care and protection. You know, on one side, why aren't you being nice to these people? The other is like, well, it would be, but, you know, we have to look after ours first or whatever. It's always that thing. And control of immigration is a rhetoric, you know, because that psychological type likes control. The other one likes liberalism and kind of a bit less control, like proclivities towards chaos or control and that sort of stuff. But yeah, that is definitely out there. Whether it will be addressed or not, I remember my PhD years ago was about this question of how do you deal with the politicization of immigration? And the whole thing was about, looked at seven different countries, and we looked at articles between 1995 and 2010. And the idea was to have a look at, see the dominance of the salience of immigration across seven different countries and see how it varied according to political discourse and political opportunity. Obviously, I was doing the Irish coding, but there was someone in the Netherlands, someone in Austria, someone in the UK doing it. We were trying to evaluate how does this whole thing manifest itself. And my conclusion from the whole thing, I was working for the British Labour Party at the time, and we were doing this whole thing about control immigration. My conclusion really was that if centre-left parties focus on integration policy, then they're really getting at the root of the issue, which is about communities and about the extent to which people feel isolated. There's a book coming out on loneliness, which talks about the emerging loneliness of younger people who, and that new generational divide of people dependent on social media. But it's also related to the older groups who also feel lonely in a different way. The kind of the people who are, you know, not instinctively racist, you could argue. They're not like BNP or anything like that, you know. But, you know, UKIP and Trump are all supported by a larger group of people who are anxious about the way the country is changing, about differences in morality and all that.
But it seems to me, though, Kevin,
about integration are worth attempting to address. And the GAA here has done a fantastic job in that.
And I think, you know, it seems to me that, you know, party strategy matters here as well. That, you know, there are, you know, in England, Labour never engaged in the question of national identity, or at least stayed very far away from it. And they were not kind of getting down into the kind of communities and doing activist work to kind of, you know, basically stem the rise of the BNP, UKIP, etc. They weren't engaging with those communities. So they left the door wide open for some party entrepreneur, if you want, to come along and mobilize and strategize and put all the weight on those issues and build a campaign around it. Of course, helped by a very willing kind of red top tabloid press that were feeding these stories and these, you know, exploiting people's insecurities and grievances and trying to, you know, put the weight on these issues and the frame, particularly around the European Union. And you see a bit of that in Western Europe as well. So I think if there is a lesson there, it's that, you know, you can't avoid these questions. You know, you kind of have to get down and engage with these. Because I tend to share your view. For most people are not necessarily racist, right? They just have a certain sense of community that would be quite different perhaps to what I would hold or to what many people who value diversity hold. And, you know, that's perfectly reasonable. It's perfectly reasonable to have those conversations. And things like the GAA, and I also think parties like Sinn Féin are, you know, mitigate the possibility of somebody exploiting it. Now, that is not to say that somebody will not exploit it, and it's not to say that there's sufficient demand for something like that. And you see it. We let's not be naive here. It exists in Irish society. Whether or not it becomes a political force is, you know, arguably one of the most interesting questions of the future of Irish politics.
I mean, your point about, just to add to your point about the newspaper, of how important that is of making the issue salient. Like, Ireland is very different to other countries in that issue isn't salient. And there is that feedback, that relationship between what the new, obviously the news can't, obviously the journalists can't avoid covering certain issues. They're not completely in control. There is a symbiotic relationship between them and their readers and the direction the readers are going in. But newspapers in Ireland haven't really covered this issue in the same way that others have. And the second thing is, I think what it requires at this point is a political entrepreneur to take it up. And it's probably going to happen at some point that someone marginally more competent or whatever than the cast of characters might be able to do it, which it then goes down that road of, you know, and what tends to happen is the centre-left, at least, tends to do very poorly about out of the whole situation because a certain chunk of their voters, as they say, tend to do relatively well. I mean, I think the point you're made earlier as well about Sinn Féin, about how Sinn Féin will suffer in that dynamic. I mean, I remember thinking in the UK, one of the issues when we're doing message testing for the Labour Party was that if you shrouded your message in the language of the left, like Marxist sort of language, if you talked about what your message was in that kind of context, then it wasn't going to be as popular as if you just stripped it out. Take out all the kind of ideological left sort of rhetoric out of the policy, and it will be a lot more popular, which suggested always to me that there's a lot of people who just aren't comfortable with the kind of red flag rows and all that sort of stuff. And so the problem in the UK was that when Labour under Miliband was the only alternative to the government, it created a vacuum for people who didn't really agree with the kind of left-wing perspective, and which UKIP basically went into that space. There was a series of by-elections in late 2013 where the turnout was very low, basically, and turnout was obviously high amongst older voters, and UKIP got, like, I think the first one they got 11%. Even though Labour won the by-election, it was Corby. The story was about UKIP, and Farage was always appearing because rather than Farage leading a party of loads of people, it was just always him. So every time UKIP got any coverage, Farage got the coverage. So it meant that this one person ended up getting loads and loads of coverage. And in the back of the by-election, because of this kind of positive story around UKIP, this new and exciting, and a force that the newspapers didn't really mind helping because they're not going to threaten their bottom line, really, are they? But every time there was a by-election, UKIP support would increase nationally. So, and then there was, it was just a series of by-elections, which unfortunately occurred, I guess, in a series, which every time UKIP would overperform expectations, and then the national support just jumps. And some of that was just an artifact of low turnout and the demographics of support for UKIP. But they tended to just bounce out of this, and then they went straight into the 2014 European elections. And they obviously did very well. And then that was it. You know, from that point on, UKIP was a party that had to be dealt with by the Tories and Labour, and had to focus on those issues that we were talking about. You know? Yeah. That's a lot of what underpins the pro-EU stuff. But like at the time, UKIP really focused on the EU as their singular message. They didn't, like, I'm not saying that to be fair to Farage or anything like that, but like, they didn't focus on immigration to the same extent. Some of his politicians did, but like, they were there as a vehicle for people who were, like, people didn't care about the EU as well, remember that. But they were there as a vehicle for people who didn't like Cameron and didn't like Miliband.
But in a sense, that's kind of my point as well, that like, this is an observation that's often lost on the commentary on Brexit. And the kind of the endless debate on the determinants of the Brexit vote, et cetera, and so on. European integration, the European Union, was not a salient issue amongst English voters, amongst British voters, before this referendum. It was just people didn't care. What somebody came along and made it salient, made it important. And in a sense, that to me, the lesson there is, you know, demand doesn't just create its own politics, you know? So, you know, parties and supply generate the politics, and it's much more iterative, and it's much more, there's a much more ebb and flow at play. And, you know, in that sense, back to your point, which I agree with, you know, my view is it wouldn't take that much for a very shrewd, tactful politician to emphasize immigration and mobilize it in a very kind of nuanced way that would become relatively successful as a strategy. I hope not. But it wouldn't surprise me if it happened.
I mean, it was certainly at the time, you're absolutely right. So in those open-ended questions that MRB, Mari used to do, they asked the open-ended question, what's the most important issue? And immigration was the number one, you know? Yeah. The EU was down at the bottom. I mean, all the way until they actually bloody hosted the referendum. I would generally blame Cameron because he saw this as a way to quell his backbenches and to try to win over support from UKIP at the same time, to kind of position himself a little bit more to the right. I mean, remember, they changed their logo from being a green tree to a tree with the flag, the Union Jack on it.
They left the EPP, they joined the more conservative right.
Yeah, they pushed in that direction, and so did Labour as well with the controls and immigration work. It wasn't believable, and that was my big issue at the time for the Labour Party. But I think that referendum didn't really have to happen. There wasn't public support for it. I think he just like felt that he had to do it because he promised it. Sounds terrible for me to look down on something like that, but why did he have to promise it was because he wanted to win over the anti-immigrant folks, basically.
Well, the rest is the rest is history, as we say, right? But listen, Kevin, let's leave it there. This has been a fascinating conversation. No doubt we will be debating these issues into the future. And thanks for your time.
Yeah, thank you.